Thank you very much indeed, Fergal. I felt it was better that I would stay in the background because I want this to be a reflection on the person who is in the foreground, namely Samuel Beckett. It is my great pleasure to be here and to see the Beckett Country Exhibition so wonderfully displayed for the first time in many years. I would first of all like to welcome Samuel Beckett's niece, Caroline, and her husband, Paddy Murphy, who are so helpful to me in my composition of both the book and the exhibition. I am most grateful, of course, to Fergal Whelan, to Alan Graham, and to Scott Hamilton and their team for organising Beckett and the State of Ireland, which incidentally is an interesting title because if you put it into lowercase, it means something else. I would also like to thank Evelyn Flanagan, who is the guardian of the exhibition in UCD. And I would like to welcome members of the original Black Cat team, David Davison, whose wonderful photography you will see in the exhibition and, of course, in this lecture, Ted and Ursula O'Brien, who allowed me to persuade them to design the book in a little cafe in Baggot Street called, if I remember correctly, Open Till 8, but now long closed. Bobby Balla, who illustrated the book and who sends his apologies as he is at a festival in Bantry. My wife, Tona, who designed the cover of the special edition with Bobby and encouraged me when the going became very rough, which it often did. And Kieran Taff, who supported the publication of the book in so many ways. And a special word of thanks to my son, Emmett, who features in what has become an iconic mountain photograph and who was thrown into the 40-foot at a very tender age as a brave boy to illustrate a famous passage in Company. Finally, I'm delighted that Aer Lingus is represented here by Colin Barrington's wife, Mary Rose, and it is great to be able to welcome the driving force in Aer Lingus in 1986, who made the exhibition possible, Terry Byrne, who has since transferred his considerable energy and talent to the theatre as a very successful director and actor. I would like also to acknowledge the presence of Jerry Jukes, who proofread the book and influenced it in many ways. So, to move on, a few words about the Beckett Country book and exhibition. My involvement with the Beckett Country all happened a little over a quarter of a century ago to celebrate Samuel Beckett's 80th birthday. The story of the book is more than the sum of its parts. It is, in fact, the story of what became a deep and lasting friendship that began in the 70s when I first had thoughts for the book. I came to realise that much of the apparently surrealistic in Beckett's writing is linked sometimes forcefully, often only tenuously, with the reality of existence. And much of this actuality emanates from his memories of Dublin, a world which he renders almost unrecognizable as he removes reality from his landscape and its people in his creation of what has been called the unreality of the real. It is, I think, apparent that much, but by no means all of Beckett's writing, has its origins in a real world, and that much of the inspirational energy in his writing emanates from the place of his childhood, which happened to be Dublin. This inspiration was to direct Beckett towards reduction rather than embellishment, towards poverty and decrepitude rather than beauty and possession, towards the land he was soon to depart, the land of his childhood of sea and mountain, that was to continue, as he put it, pulsating within him in a mighty systole, destined ultimately to find expression in the art that has so enriched our existence and our understanding of that existence. When I first met Sam in the 1970s, he was intrigued by my observation that the growing critical literature on his work, mostly written, I might add, by non-Irish academics, the Irish academic beacon at that time being directed elsewhere, was failing to recognise his Irishness and, as a consequence, his humour. It was, I think, a Japanese treatise on the deep surrealism of a passage from Company that evoked a warm chuckle in the Café de Paris. nowhere in particular on the way from A to Z, or say for verisimilitude, the Ballyogan Road. That dear old back road, somewhere on the Ballyogan Road in lieu of nowhere in particular, where no truck anymore, somewhere on the Ballyogan Road on the way from A to Z, head sunk, totting up the tally on the verge of the ditch, foothills to the left, Croker's Acres ahead, farther shade to the right and a little to the rear. So many times already round the earth, out since break of day, and night now falling, reckoning ended, on together, from naught anew, as if bound for step aside. When suddenly you cut through the hedge and vanish, hobbling across the gallops. Now, of course, for anybody seeing the word step aside, it would not be unreasonable to give it a surrealistic interpretation. The book started life well with a tribute from Samuel Beckett. He wrote, "My gratitude for this kindly light on other days." And this tribute was extended not to me personally, but to the loyal team that had made the book a reality against many odds. The original exhibition to celebrate Sam's 80th birthday, which happened to fortunately coincide with the Golden Jubilee of Aer Lingus, was first displayed at the University of Reading in May 1986 for a celebration, Beckett at 80, with readings by the late Dame Peggy Ashcroft and Ronald Pickup. Jim Knowlson and I wrote a booklet to accompany the exhibition, which I sent to Sam in Paris. And when I visited him a week later, I noticed that he had a grubby brown cloth bag with him, and after some pleasantries, he withdrew the book, the only content, from the bag, and opened it at page 14, saying hesitatingly, "Owen, I cannot reconcile this quotation from Watt with the original publication, and I have even checked back to the manuscript." I paled as we unraveled a curious happening. The piece of prose in Watt that describes Watt's journey on the train from Harcourt Street to Fox Rock should read as follows. And you will notice that Sam has put in a question mark, which was a device that he used, he told me, but rarely, usually when he was tired, and the reader is left to apply the most appropriate word. However, an adventurous, and it would seem illiterate, typesetter in Reading went one step further and corrected the text for posterity by inserting the words six chairs, so that the passage now reads as follows. My planned route from Paris to Dublin was immediately changed to Reading, much against Sam's wishes, where I sought out this genius in vain, but established that the proofs had been correct, and thence to the printers to pulp the entire run and reprint 1,000 copies with the infamous six chairs removed and the question mark restored. The exhibition was destined to travel to many destinations, over 30 worldwide, and it needed therefore sturdy crates, which were made by a defrocked priest in Reading. And it is credit to him that the exhibition has withstood the vagaries of travel for so many destinations. And once again, I acknowledge the role of Aer Lingus in making these journeys possible, and to Terry Byrne, who accompanied me on many of the exhibitions. Now, just to return to the Beckett country itself, the geographical extent is readily identified. It is confined almost entirely to the city of Dublin and the surrounding county, most especially Fox Rock and the coast of Dunleary, Killiney and Sandy Cove. The heart of the Beckett country lies in the magic landscape of the Dublin Mountains. Easy though it may be to chart the geographic borders of the Beckett country, the same cannot be said of its place in Beckett's writing. When I began my research, as I did so in the naive belief that I would have only to concentrate on the early prose works and poetry, More Pricks Than Kicks, Mercier and Camier, Murphy, Watt, the trilogy and the pre-war poetry seemed to me to contain all the influence of a place and person that was Irish in Beckett's writing. But I was greatly mistaken. The influence of Dublin and its people extends throughout Becket's work and through the Irish, and though the Irish presence faded a little in the middle period in the 50s when the French influence became dominant, it returned with increasing force in the later writings and is at its most powerful and poignant in Company, written in 1980. This evening I have chosen to reflect on what are for me the most powerful influences of place in Becket's writing. And as I do so, I will portray his Irishness and, of course, his immense humour. There are other facets, however, to Samuel Beckett's writing: despair, love, poignancy, suffering, and above all, for me, a dominant characteristic, compassion. It is this compassion, tempered as it so often is with humour, that makes the suffering that Beckett felt for fellow man bearable for the reader. In making this observation, we should spare a thought for the pain Beckett had to endure to portray so vividly the state of the world and man's at times heroic ability to contend. Let us begin at the beginning. The coincidence of Beckett's arrival on Good Friday, April the 13th, 1906, with the remembrance of an auspicious departure could, if taken at face value, be dismissed lightly or even misinterpreted as an example of Beckettian humour. But I think its profundity is deliberate, and those who ignore or demean this fail to appreciate the morality that is central to all Beckett's work. You were born on Easter Friday after long labour. Yes, I remember. The sun had not long sunk behind the larches. Yes, I remember. Or if only you saw the first light and cried at the close of day, when in darkness Christ at the ninth hour cried and died. You saw the light in the room you were most likely conceived in. The big bow window looked west to the mountains, mainly west. For being bow, it looked also a little south and a little north, necessarily a little south to Moor Mountain and a little north to foothill and plain. Cooldrina, the house in which Beckett was born, still stands, only slightly changed, but the summer house in which Beckett's father read his Punch has disappeared. There on summer Sundays after his midday meal, your father loved to retreat with Punch and a cushion. The waist of his trousers unbuttoned, he sat on the one ledge, turning the pages, you on the other with your feet dangling. When he chuckled, you tried to chuckle too. When his chuckle died, yours too. Content to tramp his beloved mountains, Bill Beckett's love of nature surpassed in his son's estimation any so-called cultural deficiencies. This delightful, tolerant, and affectionate man listened to his son, and by listening may have done more to further his development than if he had lectured him learnedly. Fortunately, my father died when I was a boy. Otherwise, I might have been a professor. He had his heart set on it. A very fair scholar I was, too. No thought, but a great memory. One day, I told him about Milton's Cosmology. Away up in the mountains, we were resting against a huge rock, looking out to sea. That impressed him greatly. Bill Beckett is portrayed by those who know him not as a simple man, but in his son's writing he rises to a higher plane, if we chose to see it, a plane on which he provides the support so craved for and so much needed by his son in childhood and adolescence. Yes, this evening it has to be, as the story my father used to read to me evening after evening when I was small and he had all his health, to calm me evening after evening, year after year, it seems to me this evening, which I don't remember much about, except that it was the adventures of one Joe Bream, or Breen, the son of a lighthouse keeper, a strong, muscular lad of 15, those were the words, who swam for miles in the night, a knife between his teeth, after a shark, I forget why, out of sheer heroism. He might have simply told me the story. He knew it by heart. So did I, but that wouldn't have calmed me. He had to read it to me, evening after evening, or pretend to read it to me, turning the pages and explaining the pictures, that were of me already, evening after evening, the same pictures, till I dozed off on his shoulder. If he had skipped a single word, I would have hit him with my little fist in his big belly, bursting out of the old cardigan and unbuttoned trousers that wrested him from his office canonicals. That Dublin is a powerful influence, the point of commencement, in fact, of much of Beckett's writing is, I think, quite evident. But that influence in itself would be insufficient to explain the genius of Beckett's talent. After all, many fine Irish writers have this common background, but have failed to achieve in their writing that something that elevates Beckett's work to an unusual pinnacle in art. If we were to examine that indefinable essence more closely, rather than merely dismissing it as genius, I suggest it is to France that we should look, not for the French language, important influence though that was to be, but to Marcel Proust, who permitted Beckett to develop the evocatory sense that allowed him to extract, as it were, the essence from his formative period. The recognisable senses of taste, smell, hearing, sight and touch provided insufficient sensory material for Proust's creative process, which remained impotent until he recognised in himself a latent other sense, a sense that has either atrophied or most likely has not developed in most of us into a recognisable sense in the terms we employ to define such physiological entities. Beckett appreciated immediately the importance of Proust's discovery of this extra sense that was not dependent so much on memory, but which added a new dimension to the creative process. So fascinated was he by this evocatory technique that he listed the fetishes, as he called them, that fired Proust's process of intellectualized animism, the Madeleine steeped in tea, the steeples of Martinville, and so on. And we can, without difficulty, draw up a list of evocatory features for Beckett, as he did for Proust: the larch tree, the smell of the lemon verbena, the granite pier of Dunleary, the tinkle of the stone cutter's hammers, and the most powerful of all, the shaving mirror in New Place. The tenuity of existence and the ephemerality of survival are evoked forcibly by Beckett in the contrasting qualities of a simple shaving mirror's material durability and the transience of its reflected image, the reflection of his father, now gone in the mirror. I can see me still with those of now, seal this long time, staring with those of then. I must have been 12 because of the glass, a round shaving glass, double-faced, fateful and magnifying, staring into one of the others, the true ones, true then, and seeing me there, imagining I saw me there, lurking behind the bluey veils, staring back sightlessly at the age of 12 or at the age of 40, for the mirror remained. My father went, but the mirror remained, in which he had so greatly changed. My mother did her hair in it with twitching hands, in another house, with no view of the sea, with the view of the mountains. If it was my mother, what a refreshing whiff of life on earth. Beckett's mother, May Beckett, is often depicted by critiques as a soulless, humourless personality, typifying the tyrannical and demanding mother so often bestowed on Irishmen in literature. There may be, of course, some truth in this assessment, but on the other hand, May Beckett did earn her son's lasting affection, even if his patience had been wearing somewhat thin. Next, another image, yet another, so soon again, the third perhaps. They'll soon cease. It's me, all of me, and my mother's face. I see it from below. It's like nothing I ever saw. We are on a veranda smothered in verbena. The scented sun dapples the red tiles. Yes, I assure you. Bow down over my curls. The eyes burn with severe love. I offer her mine, pale, upcast to the sky, whence cometh our help, and which I know perhaps even then with time shall pass away. She stops, her eyes burn down on me again. I cast up mine in haste and repeat her rye. The air thrills with the hum of insects. The Fox Rock and Leopardstown neighbourhood became a great treasure trove that Beckett plundered relentlessly in his writings. As a small boy, he was brought by his mother to one of the great events in Dublin, an aeronautical display at Leopardstown Racecourse. But I have heard aeroplanes elsewhere and have seen them in flight. I saw the very first in flight, and then in the end, the latest models. Oh, not the very latest, the very second latest, the very antepenultimate. I was present at the first loopings of the loop, so help me God. I was not afraid. It was above a race course. My mother held me by the hand. She kept saying, "It's a miracle, it's a miracle." Then I changed my mind. We were not often of the same mind. One day we were walking along the road, up a hill of extraordinary steepness. I said, "The sky is further away than you think, is it not, Mama?" It was not with malice. I was simply thinking of all the leagues that separated me from it. She replied to me, her son, "It is precisely as far away as it appears to be." She was right, but at the time I was aghast. An interesting feature in Beckett's writing is the recurrence of themes and scenes, with the same people and the same places being introduced and reintroduced repeatedly, but with startlingly different treatments. Beckett was not unaware of this. I don't know why, he said, "I told this story. I could just as well have told another. Living souls, you will soon see how alike they are." And so in another work we have, "Looking up at the blue sky and then at your mother's face, you break the silence, asking her if it's not in reality much more distant than it appears." The sky, that is, the blue sky. For some reason you could never fathom this question, must have angered her exceedingly, for she shook off your little hand and made you a cutting retort you have never forgotten. And then he returns to the theme again in another work, and he says, "A small boy, stretching out his hands and looking up at the blue sky, asked his mother how such a thing was possible. 'Fuck off,' she said." Fox Rock, Samuel Beckett's birthplace, though more developed in Beckett's childhood, still retains an atmosphere that is rural, elegant, and sheltered. Its inhabitants today, as in Bill Beckett's time, are the successful business and professional citizens of the city. There is an air of refined affluence about it. None but tranquil sounds, the clicking of mallet and ball, a rake on pebbles, a distant lawnmower, the bell of my beloved church, and birds, of course, blackbird and thrush, their song sadly dying, vanquished by the heat and leaving dawn's high boughs for the bush's gloom. The smallest incidents, the most insignificant characters, were given heroic proportions in the course of Beckett's writing. I made many trips to Paris with Beckett literally on my back, the many hundreds of photographs that were later to illustrate the book. On one poignant visit, I produced a photograph of Bill Shannon, the consumptive postman, in one of Beckett's most beautiful pieces of prose. This photograph brought tears to his eyes, and I realized it was time to bid farewell, pack my bag of photographs and slip away without words, just a hand on his shoulder to show I understood and would return anon. The crocuses and the larch turning green every year, a week before the others, and the pastures red with uneaten sheep's placentas, and the long summer days and the new mown hay, and the wood pigeon in the morning, and the cuckoo in the afternoon, and the corncrake in the evening, and the wasps in the jam, and the smell of the gorse, and the look of the gorse, and the apples falling, and the children walking in the dead leaves, and the larch turning brown a week before the others, and the chestnuts falling, and the howling winds, and the sea breaking over the pier, and the first fires, and the hooves on the road, and the consumptive postman whistling, "The roses are blooming in Picardy," and the Standard Oil lamp, and of course the snow, and to be sure, the sleet, and bless your heart, the slush, and every fourth year, the February debacle, and the endless April showers, and the crocuses. And then the whole bloody business starting all over again. Beckett was a master of creating pastoral tranquility. He could give to his prose a musicality that drew on so many images that the effect can be profoundly moving and not without humour. Take this example of spring in the foothills of the Dublin Mountains. leaning now on his stick between Leopardstown and down the hill to the north and the heights of Two Rock and Three Rock to the south, Bellacroix regretted the horses of the good old days, for they would have given to the landscape something that the legions of sheep and lambs could not give. These latter were springing into the world every minute. The grass was spangled with scarlet afterbirths. The larks were singing, the hedges were breaking, the sun was shining. The sky was Mary's cloak. The daisies were there. Everything was in order. Only the cuckoo was wanting. It was one of those spring evenings when it is a matter of some difficulty to keep God out of one's meditations. Fox Rock Village was immortalised in the radio play All That Fall and in the novel What, though it appears in many works, other works also. The entire scene, the hills, the plain, the racecourse with its miles and miles of white rails and three little stands, the pretty little wayside station. And the award-winning station to which the residents of Fox Rock were brought to and from Harcourt Street Station by the Slow and Easy features very strongly in All That Fall. Before you slink away, Mr. Barrel, please, a statement of some kind, I insist. Even the slowest train on this brief line is not 10 minutes and more behind its scheduled time without good cause, one imagines. We all know your station is the best kept in the entire network, and there are at times when that is not enough, just not enough. Now, Mr. Barrel, leave off chewing your whiskers. We are waiting to hear from you, we the unfortunate ticket holders nearest, if not dearest. Historical ornaments surround Fox Rock and all fuel the imagination of the young boy. I did not trouble Sam for explanation of the obvious when there were times I had to leave the obscurity anchored in obscurity. But there were many nudges from Paris that sent me cycling again the winding roads of the Dublin mountains. For example, David and I had spent days in the mountains in search of Foley's Folly, and eventually I arrived in Paris with what I thought must surely be the place, a folly high in the mountains, where I had picnicked lightly some days earlier in the delightful company of a drift of pigs. Sam pored over the photograph, fascinated by the beauty of the place, and then to my disappointment informed me that he had never been there. Instead, he directed me, which he might have done much earlier, but he was sometimes mischievous, he directed me to Barrington's Tower, which of course made much more sense in that it was close to Coldrina, where he had been sent supperless to bed in punishment for his childhood peregrinations. Indeed, had I acknowledged the reality of the real, I would have discovered this much earlier. I see a kind of den littered with empty tins, and yet we are not in the country. Perhaps it is just a ruined folly on the skirts of the town, in a field, for the fields come right up to our walls, and the cows lie down at night in the lee of the ramparts. I had changed refuge so often in the course of my route that now I can scarcely tell between dens and ruins. When I asked him why he had changed the name from Barrington's Tower to Foley's Folly, he said, "Owen, there is no music in Barrington's Tower." Beckett's childhood landscape was replete with follies, dens, graveyards, cromlechs, and there were monuments galore, all close to hand. Take Tully Graveyard as an example. Some 20 paces from my wicket gate, the lane skirts the graveyard wall. The lane descends, the wall rises, higher and higher. Soon you are faring below the dead. It is there I have my plot in perpetuity. As long as the earth endures, that spot is mine, in theory. Sometimes I went and looked at my grave. The stone was up already. It was a simple Latin cross, white. I wanted to put my name on it, with the here lies and the date of my birth. Then all it would have wanted was the date of my death. They would not let me. Sometimes I smiled as if I was dead already. Sam even went so far as to write his epitaph. Mine I composed long since and am still pleased with it, tolerably pleased. There is little chance, unfortunately, of its ever being reared above the skull that conceived it, unless the state takes up the matter. But to be unearthed I must first be found. And I greatly fear those gentlemen will have as much trouble finding me dead as alive. So I hasten to record it here and now, while there is still time. Hereunder lies the above, who up below so hourly dies that he lived on till now. The second and last, or rather latter line, limps a little perhaps, but that's no great matter. I'll be forgiven more than that when I'm forgotten. The Beckett boys were accomplished swimmers, and much of this was due to the bathing place, the 40-foot, which was in those days confined solely to gentlemen swimmers. And it was in this lovely spot that he wrote this lovely piece, and this is where my son was thrown in. You stand at the tip of the high board, high above the sea, in at your father's upturned face, upturned to you. You look down to the loved, trusted face. He calls to you to jump. He calls, be a brave boy. The red round face, the thick moustache, the greying hair, the swell sways it under and sways it up again. The far call again, be a brave boy. Many eyes upon you from the water and from the bathing place. Important though Fox Rock and the close by coast are as influences in Beckett's work, it is the Dublin mountains which exert the most lasting and powerful influences. With his father, he tramped these mountain slopes and summits, absorbing a terrain that has a unique magic and charm. The mountain peaks with their bog and firs, from which the city of Dublin, Dublin Bay and the Wicklow Mountains are visible in the distance, constitute a landscape which Beckett believed to be unique, a landscape that was to endure and influence. He has written, the old haunts were never more present. With closed eyes, I walk these dear back roads. A road still carriageable climbs over the high moorland. It cuts across vast turf bogs 1,000 feet above sea levels, 2,000 if you prefer. It leads to nothing anymore. A few ruined forts, a few ruined dwellings. The water of Dublin Bay, speckled with islands and ships and fringed by a coastline of rock, rivers and piers, undulates gently, its colour in harmony with the constant hue and shade of the sky above. Even the piers of the harbour can be distinguished. On a very clear day, of the two harbours, tiny arms in the glassy sea outflung, known flat, seen raised, and the islands and promontories, one is only to stop and turn at the right place. And of course, by night, the beacon lights, both flashing and revolving. It is here one would lie down in a hollow, bedded with dry heather, and fall asleep for the last time on an afternoon in the sun, head down among the minute life of stems and bells, and fast fall asleep, fast farewell to charming things. It's a birdless sky, the odd raptor, no song. End of descriptive passage. Waiting for Godot is a timeless play. No detail dates the drama or its message to any age. It will adapt to the theatre of the future as readily as it has done to the 20th century stage. As it is timeless, so too it is placeless, demanding little more for its setting than a strange tree, a country road, and desolation. Beckett removed most, but not quite all, detail that might permit identification of place in Godot. He wished to create, as Con Leventhal so aptly put it, a cosmic state, a world condition, in which all humanity is involved. He sought to free us from the restrictions that a specific location would place on interpretation. Perhaps then one should desist from even suggesting an influence in Beckett's setting for Godot. Might it be better to refrain from touching something so precious for fear of damaging it? And yet, walking the summits of the Dublin Mountains in certain weathers, the mood of Godot is so palpable that the urge to emphatically locate the drama there might be resisted, but a director in search of inspiration for the ideal setting for Godot could not find better than the lonely summit of Glen Cree with its occasional threatened tree. And finally, a mountain piece from Worstwood Ho that I probably misinterpreted, because Sam asked me once why I thought it was a father and son on a road to nowhere. But his love of what was to become an iconic photograph, me and my young son who's here this evening, would not let him dispel my rendering of the piece. Where then, but there see now another, bit by bit an old man and child in the dim void, bit by bit an old man and child, any other would do as ill, hand in hand with equal plod they go, in the free hands, no, free empty hands, backs turned, both bowed with equal plod they go. The child hand raised to reach the holding hand, hold the old holding hand, hold and be held, plod on and never recede, slowly with never a pause, plod on and never recede, backs turned, both bowed, joined by held holding hands, plod on as one shade, another shade. When Beckett left the environment, the childhood environs of Fox Rock, the mountains and the sea, to become a student and later a lecturer at Trinity College, the characters surrounding him changed, but the compassionate eye continued to observe the tragic vignettes of city life that would later influence much of his writing. During this period, Beckett lived in a garret on the upper floor of number 6 Clare Street, where the family business Beckett and Metcalfe was situated. From here he was within easy reach of humanity, an abundance of which was to be had in Dublin's many public houses. He chose his observational posts carefully. And in these pleasant surroundings, the proximity of suffering and humanity coping often majestically with the cruelty of life became tolerable and provided, moreover, an almost theatrical illusion, temporarily blunting the pain of realization. Sitting in this crapulent den, drinking his drink, he gradually ceased to see its furnishings with pleasure, the bottles representing centuries of loving research, the stools, the counter, the powerful screws, the shining phalanx of the pulls of the beer engines, all cunningly devised and elaborated to further the relations between purveyor and consumer in this domain. The bottles drawn and emptied in a twinkling, the casks responding to the slightest pressure on their joysticks, the weary proletarians at rest on arse and elbow, the cash register that never complains, the graceful curates flying from customer to customer, all this made up a spectacle in which Bellacourt was used to take delight and chose to see a pleasant instance of machinery decently subservient to appetite. On long straight Pierce Street that permitted a simple cantilena of the mind, many adventures preordained by the Bovril sign dancing through its 7 phases were enacted. But few are more poignant than that of 2 buried girls on an evening of human vicissitude in Dublin. It was a most pleasant street, despite its name, to be abroad in, full as it always was with shabby substance and honest to God coming and going. All day the roadway was a tumult of buses, red and blue and silver. By one of these a little girl was run down, just as Bellacourt drew near to the railway viaduct. She had been to the Hibernian dairies for milk and bread, and then she had plunged out into the roadway. She was in such a childish fever to get back in record time with her treasure to the tenement in Mark Street where she lived. The good milk was all over the road, and the loaf, which had sustained no injury, was sitting up against the curb, for all the world as though a pair of hands had taken it up and set it down there. The queue standing for the Palace Cinema was torn between conflicting desires to keep their place and to see the excitement. They craned their necks and called out to know the worst, but they stood firm. One little girl, debauched in appearance and swathed in a black blanket, fell out near the sting of the queue and secured the loaf. With the loaf under her blanket, she sidled unchallenged down Mark Street and turned into Mark Lane. When she got back to the queue, her place had been taken, of course, but her sally had not cost her more than a couple of yards. The death of Becket's father had a profound effect on his son, who gave expression to his feelings in the poem Malacoda. In this poem, he draws on the days spent sheltering in the National Gallery of Ireland from the wind and cold, when he likens the bouquet on his father's casket to one of the most beautiful paintings in the gallery, "Lay This Hewson on the Box." His father's burial place, Redford Cemetery in Greystones, that boneyard by the sea, was a place of frequent pilgrimage for Samuel Becket. "I visited not so long ago my father's grave, that I do know, and noted the date of his death alone, for that of his birth had no interest for me on that particular day. I set out in the morning and was back by night, having lunched lightly in the graveyard. But some days later, wishing to know his age at death, I had to return to the grave to note the date of his birth." Humour and affection, qualities which one suspects endeared young Sam to his father, disguise perhaps the sorrow and sadness that must inevitably have affected Becket on these visits to Greystones. "Personally, I have no bone to pick with graveyards. I take the air there willingly, perhaps more willingly than elsewhere, when take the air I must. The smell of corpses, distinctly perceptible under those of grass and humus mingled, I do not find unpleasant. A trifle on the sweet side, perhaps, a trifle heady, but how infinitely preferable to what the living emit, their feet, teeth, armpits, arses, sticky foreskins and frustrated ovules. And when my father's remains join in, however modestly, I can almost shed a tear. The living wash in vain perfume themselves, they stink. Yes, as a place for an outing, when out I must, leave me my graveyards and keep you to your public parks and beauty spots. My sandwich, my banana tastes sweeter when I'm sitting on a tomb. And when the time comes to piss again, as it often does, I have my pick." However, Becket's relationship with his mother may be misinterpreted by those who fail to appreciate the mores of Irish family life during the first 50 years of the last century. The fact is that Becket bore deep love for his mother, albeit perhaps with less intensity than for his father. Ireland is a land where the spoken word has many meanings, and affection often masquerades under the guise of derision. May Becket's death in a nursing home overlooking the Hubbin Bridge on the Grand Canal in Dublin caused her son intense distress, which was expressed in what I regard as one of his most powerful pieces of writing, in which is captured not only the profound sense of loss and relief that his mother's suffering was over, but also the inevitability of death and the timelessness of age, the inexorable cycle of death and birth and life, the whole business of existence. "Bench by the weir from where I could see her window. There I sat in the biting wind, wishing she were gone. Hardly a soul, just a few regulars, nursemaids, infants, old men, dogs. The blind went down, one of those dirty brown roller affairs, throwing a ball for a little white dog as chance would have it. I happened to look up and there it was, all over and done with at last. I sat on for a few moments with the ball in my hand and the dog yelping and pawing at me. Moments, her moments, my moments, the dog's moments." In drawing this Beckettian odyssey to a close, if we wish to find the moment of beginning and the place but that inspired Becket's literary genius, this commencement, or as he put it, the moment when he suddenly saw the whole thing at last, we need only turn to Crapp's last tape, where the location, the granite East Pier at Dunleary, is readily identifiable. Spiritually, a year of profound gloom and indigence, until that memorable night in March at the end of the jetty in the howling wind, never to be forgotten, when suddenly I saw the whole thing, the vision at last. This, I fancy, is what I have chiefly to record this evening, against the day when my work will be done, and perhaps no place left in my memory, warm or cold, for the miracle that, for the fire that set it alight. What I suddenly saw then was this, that the belief I had been going on with all my life, great granite rocks, the foam flying up in the light of the lighthouse, and the wind gauge spinning like a propeller, clear to me at last that the dark I have always struggled to keep under is in reality my most unshatterable association until my dissolution of storm and night with the light of the understanding and the fire. However, in the creation of this unreality of the real, we would be well advised not to discount the liberties that may be taken by a creative imagination. When I was writing in the Beckett country, I frequently brought the photographs to Paris to discuss their identity and place with Sam. One day, as I laid out David Davison's wonderful photographs of the storm-lashed Dunleary Pier and the anemometer flying in the wind, Sam confided to me, not quite apologetically, but rather in the tone of one who has pulled a fast one and is proud for having done so, that the revelatory moment, that moment when he saw the whole thing at last, had taken place on the much more humble pier at Greystone's Harbour on a black stormy night when he had been staying in the house his mother had rented in that then seaside resort. The moment on the jetty at Greystone's may have fired Beckett's literary vision, but the fulfilment of its arduous demands had to be identified, defined, clarified, and composed into a coherent vision which had to be adhered to with selfless dedication to achieve what then seemed unachievable. These demands were laid down by Beckett in the remarkable tailpiece, To What? Who may tell the tale of the old man? Weigh absence in a scale. Meet want with a span. The sum assess of the world's woes. Nothingness in words enclose. That Beckett should have postulated so demanding an advocatory vision was astounding. That he had the courage and discipline to fulfil it in every detail is testimony to the magnificence of his achievement. Once the course was charted, the process of drawing on the past began, and what treasures Beckett's prodigious memory was to provide for his writing. In closing, ladies and gentlemen, it may not be inappropriate to reflect a quarter of a century on how Beckett influenced my life. My discipline, medicine, demands compassion and feeling, or such at least would be the public's perception of the medicine man, as Lenny Bernstein affectionately liked to call us doctors. Paradoxically, the practice of medicine makes the exclusion of sentiment a prerequisite for the survival of self, and the process begun in early studentship soon becomes so integral a part of the scientific persona that the dissipated gems of idealism, among which, of course, may be found compassion, become unrecognizable. The years of training so carefully constructed by our institutions initially blunt and finally pervert the purity of avocation and the sensibility of youth, essence to be found in most medical students, but so few doctors. It is chastening, but not necessarily a balm to existence, to have this protective wall around one annihilated. And I can do no better in closing with a great sense of sadness that the Sam I once knew is no more than to quote what I wrote with a much lighter heart for a Feshkrit for his 80th birthday in 1986. The occasion is too great, my ability to express too feeble, other than to gasp in gratitude, to acknowledge the greatness of his sum, to admit that I, for one, will never be as before, whether for worse or better, I know not, but changed as no other ever could, possessing now an understanding of and feeling for fellow man as no other could inculcate in a long apprenticeship destined to do just that. The problem now is feeling too much, not being able to go on, but having to do so as only Sam knows how. Man unadorned, ugly, decrepit, depraved, laughing, despairing, majestic in his nothingness, not always without hope. A life spent with humanity in the doldrums, but only seen from afar. Now terrifyingly close, can't endure the pain once not felt, necessarily so. What now? Still gratitude for the profundity of realization. Might not have come from any other, might never have come. What then? Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.